very pleasant good morning to you. This is live from Olympia with 7th Legislative District State Senator Shelley Short and Representatives Andrew Engel and Hunter A. Bell on Okanagan Country Radio. I'm your host, Tracy Ellis, with the Washington State Senate Republican Caucus. You can email me with your questions. It's tracy.ellis@leg.wa.gov. That's T-R-A-C-Y dot E-L-L-I-S at L-E-G dot W-A dot G-O-V. Or you can call 509-826-0100, 509-826-0100, and ask your questions that way, and we'll make sure and get those to your legislators here in Olympia. And first off, a very good morning to everyone. Senator Short, why don't we start with you? Something that's really, I know, unnerving you and a lot of people here in Olympia and throughout the state is this majority Democrat push to try to weaken the parental rights initiative. This is the initiative that passed last year. Can you talk a little bit about what's happening with that?
Sure. First, good morning, everyone. This is the initiative, when it passed, was an initiative to the legislature. And so we actually passed it in the House and Senate, which I think was a ruse, frankly, because they didn't want that on the ballot, that tremendous support across party lines. And so we passed it there. Now, Senate Bill 5181 would undo it. And it's actually worse than that. It adds a private right of action, which is code for lawsuits, and it adds an emergency clause. So if this bill gets signed into law, there's no ability for all of you to do a referendum to overturn it. The big thing that it really gets at is medical information for the students in school, where the initiative allowed complete access for a parent of their child for medical records, things that go on, any kind of, medical treatments that might be administered at the school, which it should. By the way, your children are yours, not the state's. They overturned that. They say, well, we'll give you, first of all, you don't have any right to the medical information. And if they choose to let you know that your child was hurt at school, then they use the term that the parent would be notified as soon as practicable. It's really offensive. In fact, the chair of the committee, or the chair who actually, the vice chair of the education committee, Senator Claire Wilson, actually voted for the initiative as it was written. And in her comments on the floor said, this is within current law. So there was nothing in the parental rights initiative that overturned anything she would care about. But now she's the sponsor of the bill to overturn the initiative she voted for.
Representative Engel, I know it seems like this is originating in the Senate, but are you hearing about any of this in the House as well?
People care a lot about parental rights, and so I haven't seen anything about it in the House, but absolutely it's something I'm tracking and something that, honestly, I heard a lot about this even during the course of the campaign. People are concerned about protecting parents' rights and their children and not handing that over to the state.
I know, just from hearing some of the things you've already said, Representative Abel, that this is important to you as well.
Oh, yeah, very much so. I heard about this a lot during the campaign. I've been hearing about this over the last couple of weeks here in Olympia. This is something that I know all of us are keeping our eyes on.
Another thing we're keeping our eyes on is something that's happening in the House right now that it's a little bit inside baseball. I'm going to have you guys explain it, but there was a rule change in the House of Representatives. So what is it, Representative Abel, and why should people care?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So you're right. It is a little bit inside baseball, but both of the chambers of the legislature operate on a set of rules, and the rules have to be adopted at the beginning of each session. In the House, we've had a rule going back all the way to the 1890s that deals with what the threshold is required to cut off debate. So for, way over 100 years, the threshold here in the State House of Representatives has been two-thirds to cut off debate. And then last week, without a tremendous amount of notice, our friends on the majority decided they wanted to propose a rule that would cut that all the way down to a simple majority so that they could just, essentially cut off the debate with 50% plus one of the votes. Now, of course, as you know, they've got a lot more than that in the House. But that was really concerning for us because really the purpose of debate is both for the minority position to be heard, but it's also for the benefit of the majority, for them to hear the concerns about the other side, for them to have the opportunity to make informed decisions about the bills. And so for us, this was pretty concerning that this is the beginning of the session. Basically, they've made clear that they disagree with our policy solutions, but now they've told us they don't even want to hear them anymore. Mm. So that's a real concern from my perspective.
Representative Engel, I know that you're concerned about it as well.
Absolutely. I think this is one of those areas that the Democrats already have complete control. They can pass whatever bills they want. The only thing we have as the minority is the right to speak on behalf of our constituents. And so up until the last 100 years, Republicans have had the ability, or whoever was in the minority, it hasn't always been the Republicans, have had the ability that every member had a right to speak to every bill that was before it was voted on, only up to 3 minutes before cutoff, and it had to be related, you know, germane to the bill that's being discussed. And so that the fact that they would take the authority away for us to have a right to that, and they say that they're going to allow us to still have robust debate, but it remains to be seen. We no longer have a right to it. Now it's up to their goodwill to allow us to discuss and say what we think needs to be said about these bills before they're voted on. Once it gets voted on, we're almost always going to lose unless we can make a good argument. And if people can't hear our arguments, it's going to make that a lot harder.
Well, and if I might just be able to add something, you know, the banned natural gas bill was very alive and well in the House because of them essentially doing what the minority does, which is, you know, having every member talk, essentially. They know that at some point, you know, you're getting close to, like, deadlines or cutoffs and things like that, where the minority can actually have a chance at maybe affecting a bill's outcome. It's happened several times in the past. And really, that rule just ensures that won't ever be the case.
And we should make it clear to people that if there's a two-thirds majority requirement to do something, that means Republicans have a say, because Democrats in the House don't have a two-thirds majority. But if it's just a simple majority, Republicans have no say, essentially. That's what we're talking about here. So if you have a debate, and I think it's especially important for members like you who are on the east side of the mountains, because the west side legislators may not know what the concerns of people on the east side. Completely, in some respects, it's like a different state, right? So, I mean, it's super important, I would imagine, for you to be able to explain what your constituents are feeling and thinking, right?
Oh, yeah, very much so. I mean, it's the old idea that all too often we get one-size-fits-all solutions from over here in Olympia. What works or might work in King County or Pierce County may not well work well in Stevens County or Ferry County. You know, there's another piece of this that I think is really important, and that is that the Democrats, in instituting this rule change, said that they want to avoid what they called Republican filibusters. And I think that actually brought some kind of smiling and laughing on our side of the aisle, because a filibuster, you know, kind of brings to mind this idea of people reading from the phone book or reading Charles Dickens on the floor, something completely unrelated. And what the Democrats know, and what we know as well, is that Washington State, our legislature, has a germaneness rule. So when you're speaking on a bill, it has to be germane to the rule. So when people are getting up and talking about these bills, it's because they're passionate about these bills and trying to explain why it may or may not work in their district. And so, you know, some pretty significant misdirection there by the Democrats in trying to shut down a quote-unquote filibuster when they know full well that's not all what we're dealing with.
Yeah, it's not a filibuster or something that is really just in the U.S. Senate. It's just debate. It's lengthy debate, because in the House there are a number of different people on both sides who want to speak to these issues. And so sometimes it takes a long time, right? But that's part of the process. Senator Short, I mean, you're the Senate floor leader. And so I'm just curious. I can't imagine something like this happening in the Senate. It just seems like there is a little bit more respect for the minority in the Senate. Would you say that's true?
Absolutely. Although I will tell you that last year there were a couple of bills where the former floor leader, who's now their majority leader, would look me in the eye and go, really? And I'm like, uh-huh, yep, yep, we're continuing. And the one thing, just to point out to listeners, too, and this is totally inside baseball, but this is what we deal with when we're debating bills in the House and Senate, is the way they usually do it is they cut, you know, right now you can have 10 minutes of debate, you know, per person. Generally, what they do is they cut that down to 3 minutes. And that's kind of their way of, yes, we're going to have debate, but you're going to have to make your case and say it quick. And we do oftentimes have that 3-minute rule, depends on deadlines. But the Senate does not do that. And frankly, my job as floor leader, if they started doing that, I would be throwing up all kinds of objections. I would be asking for bills to be read and really just grind the process to a halt. And they know that. But they have been much more amenable to have us have our say. And it's not our say individually. For folks back home, it's your say. It's the ideas you have, the principles you have, the things that you're concerned about. Our chambers, the House and Senate, should be places where we have a diversity of opinion, a diversity of ways of maybe amending bills or the topics, and to have that play out because we're a diverse state. And this just flies in the face of it.
This is live from Olympia on Okanagan Country Radio. I'm Tracy Ellis with the Washington State Senate, with State Senator Shelley Short and State Representatives Andrew Engel and Hunter A. Bell. And one thing I know that your constituents are, well, maybe they're not concerned about it because they may not know about it yet, but one thing that's important to your constituents is the ability to use a wood stove, a pellet stove, that sort of thing. There is a bill here in the legislature this year that is actually threatening the ability for people to purchase those stoves here in Washington State. Senator Short, why don't we start with you, because I know you brought this up recently. What's the bill? Why is it important?
So this bill, we heard it Friday in the Energy and Environment Committee. What the bill would do, there are several parts. One part, it would just mandate that these stoves meet federal standards, which candidly, I'm not opposed to because they do already. The ecology would tell you, well, we need open-ended rulemaking. That's code. That's code for doing whatever they want. They want to, quote-unquote, review the, you know, because they have to go through, you know, the process of making sure that their stoves comply with the ambient air quality, so just basically your soot air emissions. And they want to be able to review that material, which seems duplicative to me. But the key here is open-ended rulemaking. So they would then determine which stoves could be sold in the state of Washington, which if that ratchets back, then the costs are going to go up. But I believe there's a different thing. I have watched this issue since day one in the legislature when I was first elected to the House, and they wanted to limit use of wood stoves. I believe their end goal, quite frankly, is to institute the state's own emissions rules when it comes to these stoves. Now, they won't say that now, but the rulemaking is open-ended. When we got to the hearing on Friday, I had a list of questions, and frankly, there were quite a few, you know, and got to about question 4, and then I got cut off. They made it the last bill to be heard, which is code for they really don't want people to testify. And I know there were several people who texted me afterward and said they never got to share their comments. So, you know, I'm going to try and whittle the bill down to, okay, right now these stoves have to meet federal standards. Fine. They claim, ecology claims, again, kind of in the weeds a little bit, but just so you know where it's coming from, well, EPA didn't do a good job. We don't have any faith in EPA doing the right job. We need to protect Washingtonians. And I think it's just a ruse, frankly. So stay tuned. I'm fighting this hard. We're going to try and whittle the bill down. I would just like it if the bill never made it out, but I do think that they will push this bill forward.
If there are different rules for wood stoves in our state, wouldn't that be difficult for the wood stove makers? I mean, all of a sudden they have, you know, the rules are all the same in all the other states, and now it's like they're different in this state. Wouldn't they just possibly not sell their stoves in this
100%. You are so 100% right on. And frankly, I think it goes, I don't think it meets muster with the Commerce Clause, you know, and just interstate commerce, frankly. So I that's, that's me saying I know that years ago that's where they wanted to go. But again, now we have rulemaking that's going to be open-ended, and they'll just say, well, it's just to ensure that only stoves that are sold here meet these strict criteria. Folks, Ecology already has the ability to work with EPA, and they already have the ability to share their concerns with EPA. They have that dialogue. This is a solution in search of a problem, and it's not good. It's just, it's not good for our way of life. And we know that wood burning stoves and pellet stoves are some of the most efficient, economical ways to provide electricity and heat. So stay tuned.
Representative Engel, Abel, rather, I checked out where your ranch is just because I was curious. I would imagine that if you don't have a wood stove sometimes and power goes out, you'd be without heat for a while out there.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I'm just shaking my head as I'm hearing about this and thinking about this. So many individuals in the 7th District heat with wood. That's how they keep their family warm. You know, we have a cold snap. This can be a life or death issue. And I think it really illustrates the ongoing disconnect that we have with this idea of a one-size-fits-all approach that may or may not work in a more urban area, but definitely won't work in a more rural area like out in the 7th District.
And in rural areas like the 7th District, hunting and fishing is it's a part of the people who live in cities may not understand. It's really a part of the fabric of the community. It's a huge part of life in those areas. And this Fish and Wildlife Commission, there's some controversy surrounding it right now. It can get a little bit in the weeds, as Senator Short likes to say, but it's important for people to understand the dysfunction that's happening on this commission and how that impacts the ability of people in the 7th District to hunt and fish.
It does. It does. So right now, the Ruckelshaus Center did a report on just all things commission related. How do they work? What's their mission? All of those things. And the report findings, I think, kind of surprised the commission because it 100% showed that it is not workable. The Ruckelshaus Center interviewed people all across the state of Washington, and it was very clear that the commission's become political. And when I mean political, you know, more of an animal rights focus, you know, versus, fish and wildlife, you know, kind of changing that fish and wildlife, state fish and wildlife's mandate from the inside. And we had the report in our committee. It was very interesting. I'll just share a number of ideas that people have had is do a different appointment process, get rid of it altogether, put the State Department of Fish and Wildlife back in as a cabinet agency. Most folks aren't for that. And then the third one is really, you know, really look at how we can restore faith in this entity that does really important work in providing an opportunity for people across the state to share their information and their passion for the management of fish and wildlife. And I think that third option is really going to be where people land. The question is how to do that and really to create accountability. I know all three of us have been getting a lot of really good comments about how that might be done. But folks, when it comes down to it, laws mean something. And when an entity comes in because of the people who have been appointed and decide to undermine that from the inside out, folks, we've got a huge problem. And that's exactly what's going on. In fact, in the waning days of the of Inslee's administration, he appointed two members to the commission, did not allow Governor-elect Ferguson, now Governor Ferguson, and he has something to say about it. He would like those appointments back. He thinks it's more germane for him to proceed with those appointments. I agree. There's things that have to happen, so I really can't go into it at the moment, but I think there is movement in that regard. So hopefully it'll take a different tone.
Another thing, I know Representative Engel, you're hoping takes a different tone in the Senate than in the House, is this rent control bill that seems to be zooming through the legislature.
Absolutely. That's a bill that was heard immediately following my getting sworn in 2 weeks ago. And, of course, the opening ceremonies went long, and so we only had half as much time as was scheduled. And so the rent control hearing you know, most people weren't able to testify. They'd traveled a long ways. And we executed it out of committee last week, I believe it was, it wasn't a strict party line vote. One Democrat actually voted against it, but they had stacked the committee in such a way that they could lose one vote and still pass it out of committee. So that'll be going to the House floor. You know, there's a lot of concerns with it. I think most of us care about low-income people and their ability to get housing, and that's been a real challenge. I think we can have empathy for people who are getting exorbitant rent increases. I just don't think that having a cap on rent increases of 7% is actually going to address the problem. There's other problems with this bill also, like the 1.5% cap on late fees, which for a lot of my rentals would be less than $10. That's not very much incentive for people to actually pay their rent. And I often use that as a negotiating point, too. If they come to me ahead of time and say, I'm not going to be able to pay rent on time, can you give me an extra week? I'll say, yes, as long as you pay it within that time frame we agreed to, I'll waive the late fee. $10 isn't going to have that same effect. So there's a lot of concerns with the bill. I think if you talk to people who work in the low-income housing space, a lot of them have told me that they have concerns this bill will actually harm low-income tenants in the long run.
When it comes to the floor, obviously, I would imagine both of you, Representative Abel, also, you've indicated that you'd be against it. Do you think is there a chance to kill this bill still in the House, or do you think it's a foregone conclusion that it's headed over to the Senate?
Boy, that's a great question. I still think there's a chance to kill it. You know, the amount of feedback that I've heard in the last number of weeks on this has been really tremendous and extraordinary, and I think in many ways it scrambles a lot of the political calculus. Now, that being said, you know, the majority is the majority. They've made very clear that this is a huge priority for them, and so, you know, we're going to see what it looks like, but I'm a never-say-die person.
Right.
So, you know, I don't think the writing's on the wall just yet, but they've made clear that this is a priority.
Yeah, this is one of those examples where the robust debate is going to be super important, and if all of a sudden there's a motion made to cut off debate, you know, not every thought and idea might get heard in a situation like that. It's just a bill that's an example of where this could be pretty harmful, the rule change that we talked about earlier. Senator Shore, what do you think its chances are in the Senate?
Well, we ended up, that House bill that passed last year ended up not making it out of the Housing Committee. But so at the beginning of every new biennium, the majority, you know, the majority relooks at committees, who sits on those committees and the structure of the committees. And it is very clear that this year they have stacked that committee. So there is not the ability of that bill to just, you know, to not have a vote, to fail, essentially. So, I mean, we're going to keep at it. I mean, obviously, we're talking with our colleagues across the aisle to determine if it does make it to the floor, you know, might we have, you know, some Democrats who vote with us. It's still a little early to tell, but I want folks back home to know that we are working on that.
Another thing that I know you're working on in something that everyone, a lot of people are very concerned about, is this bill that would allow cities and counties to raise taxes by 3% instead of the 1% that's currently allowed. Now, we should let people know that cities and counties could raise the property tax by as much as they want with a vote of the people. So you go to voters and say, we need more revenue. Here's why. Will you allow us to raise it, you know, 5%, 6%, whatever? But there's a cap right now that is 1% that they can do every single year. They can raise it by 1% if they want. Democrats are proposing to increase that cap to 3%, and that's tripling. Property taxes is one of those areas that, in especially with people who are on a fixed income, that can really hurt them, right? I mean, what are your thoughts on this bill and its chances moving forward?
Well, I think that taxes should be difficult to raise. The 1%, I think that's reasonable. More than that, really, it should go to the vote of the people. It should be people should have the opportunity to weigh in directly on the taxes that they're going to pay. Personally, I think it should actually be a supermajority in general to raise taxes. But here, I'm going to oppose this bill for sure.
Yeah, I agree. I will also be opposing this bill, but I have a slightly different thought on this. I think this is really illustrative of the other side's thinking in this session. So we just talked about the rule change where they want to make it easier to cut off debate. Right? They don't even want to hear our solutions to answers. Now they want to also make it easier to raise taxes, right? The existing constraints are too much for them. That will make it much easier to take more money out of the pocketbooks of the people of Washington State. So I think this just illustrates, again, the thoughts and the priorities of the majority party. And it's concerning for me as we continue into this session.
Well, one thing I'd like to add here, because we've seen it with bills that, quote unquote, they don't raise taxes in the bill themselves, but they give the authority to the local legislative authority, our counties and cities, to do that. And absolutely, I mean, first and foremost, it needs to go to a vote of the people. But when I look at legislation like that, that gives the authority to do it, you're opening that door. And so my first look at a bill of that nature, I believe, is one and the same. It's one and the same because you've given the authority to the local governments to be able to, you know, put that proposal out to the people. Now, you know, people would say, well, don't you trust voters? Of course I do. But frankly, when I look at a bill, it's how do the people I represent look at the bill? And what they're going to say is, you just authorize them to be able to raise taxes, even if it requires that I have to vote, you know, up or down on that proposal. They still see it as opening that door.
That's 7th Legislative District State Senator Shelley Short. Also here, Representatives Andrew Engel and Hunter A. Bell. This is Okanagan Country Radio, live from Olympia. We'll be back. I'm Tracy Ellis with the Washington State Senate.
I'm William Shatner. I've been around a long time, but I'm truly humbled when I see the real battles our brave, paralyzed veterans have faced defending our freedom and when they come home.
I had just come home from serving over in Germany. Next thing I know, it was 3 weeks later. I was paralyzed.
While parachuting with my platoon, my parachute didn't open, and I broke my neck. It left me paralyzed for the rest of my life.
I was on a routine patrol, and we were in the desert of Kuwait, and the vehicle flipped and landed on top of me, which left me paralyzed from the waist down.
Okay, folks, this is heroism. That's why I'm proud to support Paralyzed Veterans of America, because they've kept their promise to never leave a fallen soldier behind. A roof over their heads, accessible homes, cars, jobs, benefits.
PVA has brought me back to life.
Show them their sacrifice hasn't been in vain. Go to PVA.org to learn how you can make a difference.
Hey, Max, you look absolutely dashing in that purple tie. Ready to harness the world?
You bet, Daisy. I'm ready as I'll ever be. And might I say, your purple tie really pops with your vest.
Thanks. I almost went with a cape, but didn't want to come across as pretentious.
Nonsense. Anyone in our line of work should rock a cape.
You might be onto something, Max.
Phew. So here we go. First day on the job. You've got this, right?
Right. Don't forget, we both graduated from Dogs, Inc. with honors.
Which means I can guide my human around a busy city with ease.
And I can give my human a restful night.
I hope my human is kind and loving.
And I hope mine likes wet kisses and zoomies.
Ready to make a difference?
Born ready. Let's go. Discover how extraordinary dogs like Daisy and Max change lives at no cost to the recipients. Visit dogsinc.org.
As you age, you may have questions about finding transportation, healthy meals, or other services around your home and in your community. And the Elder Care Locator has the answers at 1-800-677-1116. Our caring advisors can connect you to trustworthy local experts and the support you need to age well at home. Real people, real assistance, and real connections are just a phone call away with the Elder Care Locator. 1-800-677-1116.
Yeah. It's 8:35. This is live from Olympia with 7th Legislative District State Senator Shelley Short and Representatives Andrew Engel and Hunter Abel on Okanagan Country Radio. I'm Trace Yellis with the Washington State Senate. One of the things that seems to happen every session now is Democrats propose new bills. I guess they would say limiting firearms. I think a lot of people would say limiting people's ability to really their Second Amendment rights. And sometimes people forget that this is actually in the U.S. Constitution. It's a right. It's not just, you know, something that it's not like a driver's license, which is a privilege. This is a right to own firearms. But, you know, again, this legislative session, this is something that Democrats have made a priority. And I know Republicans are making a priority to fight these bills.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought this up. I mean, not only is it in the U.S. Constitution, it's also in our state constitution. Article 1, Section 24 says that the right to bear arms shall not be impaired. And what we're seeing this session is that the majority has brought forward a series of bills that, at least to my mind, do exactly that. So they're proposing an 11% tax on the purchase of firearms. They're proposing a one gun per month restriction. And a restriction on purchasing beyond a certain number of amount of ammunition. They're proposing a bill that would require a new permit to purchase a firearm, and then a bill that would have a double locking requirement for firearms in your house or in your vehicle. And, you know, for my concern, this is a broad attack on our Second Amendment rights under the federal constitution and our right to keep and bear arms under our state constitution. It's really disconcerting. One thing I'll say on the firearms tax is, you know, out in the 7th District, this frankly just makes me, one, be enraged, but two, kind of laugh, because a lot of folks will just go across the border over into Idaho and buy, you know, everything over there. We've been calling it somewhat tongue-in-cheek the Idaho Firearms Stimulus Bill, because I think, you know, folks across the border, their sales will skyrocket, but it will hurt sales here on this side of the border. And more importantly, it goes directly to doing what they're not supposed to be doing under the state constitution, which is impairing our right to keep and bear arms.
But at the same time, so there's a bill in the Senate that, just to give folks a little bit of background, if you are caught in the commission of a crime where you use a firearm, there's an enhanced penalty that goes along with that. The bill would do away with it. So apparently, you know, the majority party is okay with criminals having guns and using those guns in commission of crimes, but they're not okay with law-abiding citizens having the ability to protect themselves and their families. It just shows you how absolutely backward and crazy this is.
Representative Engel, do you have thoughts on these what some would call attacks on the Second Amendment?
Absolutely. They are attacks. It's a continual infringement upon our rights to keep and bear arms. And so, these are largely going through Hunter's committee. I'll probably, unfortunately, have an opportunity to vote on them on the floor, but all these bills are bad, and I'm opposing anything that infringes our rights to bear arms.
And one thing I'll tag on to that is the number of people who have signed in to testify on these bills has been extraordinary, in the sense that tremendous opposition, really significant, thousands of people. And so to me, that's encouraging that people are passionate and fired up about this. But to have a shot of slowing this down or stopping this is going to require continued involvement by the public.
And Representative Abel, obviously you're passionate about this because your constituents are passionate about it, but also from you're a constitutional attorney, from a legal standpoint, I mean, really putting aside the political part of it, just looking at it from the law, do you see this as clearly a violation of the Constitution?
I do. And this was interesting. During committee, I asked the bill's sponsor on the permit to purchase bill. And I just asked her, and this wasn't a gotcha question, I just asked her if she could explain in her own mind about how it complies with Article 1, Section 24 of the Constitution that says that the right to keep and bear arms shall not be impaired. And she kind of smiled and laughed and said, well, I'm not a lawyer. And to me, that
did,
was...
Did you say why?
Well, yeah. I didn't say that.
That was big of you.
Yeah, well, but I thought it was revealing and concerning, frankly, from my perspective. We all take an oath to support the Washington State Constitution. And again, driving home the point, this wasn't a gotcha question. I wanted her to articulate in her own mind, you know, for my benefit and the other members of the committee, how do you see us as, see this as complying with the state constitution? I didn't get an answer there, at least not one that I think was really satisfying.
You know, it is important what you're citizen legislators, right? So what you do in beyond your work in the legislature is important, and it does help. Like, for example, Representative Engel, when we talk about rent control, we're not just talking about something that you have an opinion on. I mean, you own units. You own units that, for low-income people, basically, right? I mean,
that's
so
right.
You really know what this we're talking about, right? So your personal, I mean, that's a huge part of being a citizen legislator, I think, is bringing that experience from your lives outside of the legislature into the legislature.
Absolutely.
Talking with 7th District legislators Senator Shelley Short and Representatives Andrew Engel and Hunter A. Bell on Okanagan Country Radio. Earlier, we were talking about the Fish and Wildlife Commission. I mentioned hunting and fishing, but another issue regarding fish and wildlife that is super important in your district are wolves, for a number of different reasons. But that is something I know that you personally have bills on this session. Talk about those bills, what they would do, and why they're important.
Yeah, so both of our first bills that we introduced were wolf bills. Yours is a little bit broader. Andrew, do you want to talk about yours first, and I'll talk about mine?
Sure. Yeah, so my bill would basically, let me step back. So wolves in Washington are on our endangered species list as threatened. And the Fish and Wildlife Commission, the Fish and Wildlife Commission was given a recommendation by the agency to downlist them to sensitive, and they, in a 5-4 vote, rejected that recommendation, which was really based on science and the evidence, and it's clear that these animals are not in any endangered state. In fact, a lot of other species are in danger from them. So my bill would codify that recommendation. It would require wolves to be downlisted to sensitive. It doesn't make it a free-for-all. It doesn't allow hunting, but it would allow increased management options for the agency to deal with conflicts. And I've been enjoying this bill. I've been out talking with as many diverse stakeholders as I can. I've met with Conservation Northwest. I went to the Washington Conservation Action Coalition, I think it's called, which is basically the organization that represents all the other environmental organizations, and told them about my bill. And I said, I'm looking for anyone who might have a problem with my bill to come talk to me about it before it gets a committee hearing. Hopefully it does get a hearing. And I'm trying to find anybody who's got a problem with it to talk with me. And I think that'll help me position to really argue strongly in the hearing should it get one.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting to see both our bills move forward. Mine is a localized management bill. It provides for localized management of our wolf population if the number of wolves both statewide and in certain counties are at a threshold level. And really the design and the intent here is to provide the counties the ability to manage the wolf populations in a way that right now we're just seeing the commission is not doing. You know, I think we talked a little bit before about the Ruckelshaus report, finding that the commission's is acting in a dysfunctional manner. In many ways, that was, really telling a lot of folks what we already knew. But it was nice to hear it from an outside source that what's happening now is not working, and so we're trying to figure out some tools that will work.
And Senator, for this wolf situation, the representatives are both freshmen, but this has been something that has been on your radar for a long time now, hasn't it?
It has. It has. 2012 was a memorable year, not in good terms. That's when one of our ranchers lost, hundreds of his sheep. That's when the wolves really started colonizing in Northeast Washington. But folks, everybody here in our district knows we have absolutely recovered wolves in the state of Washington, right in our district. And I don't say that to spark comment or anything else, but it's the reality. And when it's hard. The things that we're working on, and I think folks who may oppose it or be worried you know, I want you to know that all of these things we're doing are with stakeholders. They're also done in concert with the department. You know, none of this, restructures how, the parties that need to be at the table, if you will. And I want folks to really understand that. But for our district, for Northeast Washington, for Ferry County, these areas where there are so many PACs, they're just on top of each other, and the impacts that our ranchers, last year was brutal, absolutely brutal. And to me, there needs to be an obligation of the department to, whether you call them chronic areas or chronic PACs, whichever you do, that they, all our ranchers have ever asked is just take care of the problem. We know not all wolves are a problem, but for the PACs that are, we need to deal with them and deal with them aggressively. So that really informs where we go. And it informs the things that we work on, because of the same things that we've seen on the ground. One of the things, so I have a bill that's like Rep. Abel's, just to give it kind of another chance, you know, depending on what happens in the House. But I also have one for ranchers who have tried to do indirect compensation. And what that really does, if at the end of the season you have a higher percentage of losses, you know, livestock that just do not come home, you don't know where they're at, you don't know what happened, then you have an ability, along with low pregnancy rates and those kinds of things, to be able to be compensated. Look, most ranchers just want to do what they do, and I get that. But it is a tool, and it's not working very well. So I have a bill to deal with that, and it just essentially tools it in a little bit different way. I'm working that bill through committee. A lot of our smaller ranchers that just really kind of need that help, if you will, because they're seeing increased numbers that don't come home, or they're not seeing the higher pregnancy rates, and they can document that, then I want that to work smoother and better. So folks that do want to take advantage of that can, but ultimately, you know, we've recovered wolves in the state of Washington, and I share that everywhere I go, because even though they're not in other parts of the state, or they're starting to come, but it, you know, there's slow recovery in those areas, we've done it in northeastern Washington. And I think to the department, when they put forward the rule to downlist them from endangered to sensitive, was really done because, really frankly, I think wolves are here. I think you could be aggressive with packs that are a problem, and you would still have growth in wolf population. I'm absolutely confident of that. So stay tuned, and we'll see where we get.
Yep. If I could just jump in real quick, too, on this further. When we have a species that's permeating the environment listed as endangered, it undermines the public's trust of a whole concept of an Endangered Species Act. I believe we as humans should not be exterminating species from the landscape, but we really undermine people's whole trust in the whole concept when there's a species that's everywhere, it's causing lots of harm. We've even seen the wolves that eliminate our last caribou herd. I know I heard that from the Kalispell tribe in North America. And to say that they are still endangered is offensive and undermining public trust.
One thing that undermines public trust in some areas is this shortage of law enforcement officers. And it's a shortage. I mean, per capita, Washington has the fewest number of law enforcement officers, something that I think at this point, finally, it seems like everybody agrees needs to be dealt with. Even Democrats all of a sudden are on board, and the governor, I think we mentioned this last week, said he won't pass a budget without Senator Jeff Holley's bill earmarking $100 million for the hiring of police officers. This is a huge issue, and is this an area where we could finally talk about possibly some good news in the legislature this session?
Yeah, I think so. It was very interesting during the governor's inaugural that he cited Senator Holley's bill to provide for $100 million for the hiring of police officers as a bill that he wants to sign. I was very pleased. I've introduced the House companion bill on that, so I'm trying to lead the charge for us there in the House. But I hear about this all the time, about a lack of law enforcement officers, and of course this touches on so many other issues. It touches on our ongoing issues with with drugs and fentanyl. It touches on our really very disconcerting rates for retail theft and automobile theft. This is a quality of life issue. People live in this state because they want to live in this state, but they want to feel safe and secure for them and their families when they're here. So I think this was a good note in the governor's inaugural address. He wants to sign this bill, and so I'm doing whatever I can to try and help get him a bill to his desk.
And Senator, sure, this was Senator Hawley's bill is a bipartisan bill too.
Oh, absolutely, and it really has been from day one. It kind of makes us look at the difference of this new administration from the previous one. And look, you know, actions are going to speak louder than words, but the fact that he would, you know, has clearly signaled wanting to work across the aisle and work on things that are really meaningful and need to be done in the state of Washington is a breath of fresh air. I'm just really proud of Senator Hawley's work, continued work, along with Representative Abel's, that to just recognize that public safety in our communities, with all of the challenges that we have right now, is like the most important.
There's an additional piece to this, too. One part is the hiring of more law enforcement officers, but the other one is addressing the crisis of morale in our law enforcement
community. Yeah, that's a big deal. People don't understand that money's one thing, and that'll help, but you got to have people. You know, Senator Hawley always says when he was a police officer, it was something that people wanted to do. They felt like they were making a difference in the world.
Yeah,
people may not have that feeling.
No, we've got to get back to this notion that a uniform and a badge and a gun is an honor to have, and that it's a profession that's respected and honored in the community. I'm cautiously optimistic about this new tone we're hearing out of the governor's office. Again, the legislature, I think, is working hard to try and get a good bill to the governor's desk. But this is going to be a long-term effort to try and increase the morale in our law enforcement community here in the state of Washington. But it's something that I know we're committed to.
Any other bills that you all are sponsoring that you want people to know about? And we'll start with you, Representative Engel. What do you have?
Yeah, so I've got three bills that I'm going to be dropping probably this week. Two of them are related to housing. One of them I'm calling the Family Housing Act. It would allow – it's a common situation in rural areas that you have land use restrictions. So, like, for example, my parents are in R20 area. They have one house, and they can't –
What does that mean, R20?
So R20 means that it's the rural area. It's a zoning category. So
okay.
R, rural, 20 is 20-acre minimum lot size.
So one house per 20 acre.
Correct.
Okay.
And so let's just say my parents were getting older and they wanted me to live near them, I couldn't currently, under current law, build a house there. There are some other legislation that could address that, but mine would allow them to subdivide off a piece of land less than 20 acres so that a family member could build a house adjacent to them and help keep an eye, and it promotes this family community.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
So it would also allow other – I've heard this story from other people. It would allow people the ability to live near family members. And it's not going to be dramatically used. I've got some guardrails on there so developers can't use it to, you know, destroy rural character. That's what the Democrats are always worried about. So I think it has some potential there. Another one would be most communities or most counties have some historic communities. So maybe there used to be a sawmill there or a mine, and so there's a cluster of houses, but it's not a city. And it's not an urban growth area. It would allow an extra category so counties could designate these and allow those communities to grow. Whereas currently, if you have this rural zoning, let's just say it's R20 or R5, 5-acre minimum, but you've got a bunch of half-acre lots in a cluster, it would allow some more development around that to give some more flexibility for addressing our housing crisis. And then the other bill has to do with what's called Group B water systems. And so this is when people share a well. So Group B is you can have two families share a well with no restrictions. 3 to 14 homes sharing a well is called a Group B water system. And they're currently required to have hire a contractor to oversee this and be their liaison with the Department of Health. But if they're simple systems, they're not actually required to report anything to the Department of Health anyways. They're just required to pay this person for really nothing.
Yeah.
And so my bill would say if you have 3 to 9 with low complexity systems, you could eliminate that need to hire that contractor. And it would really add flexibility in rural communities to be able to share wells in a more efficient manner. And I think it also goes to address our housing crisis.
Senator Short, it sounds like your growth management stuff is contagious there in the 7th District. Senator Short's always working on Growth Management Act issues, it seems like. I'm sure you have some this session as well, right?
I have one. The other side is not in love with it. The Growth Management Act, I think, by and large, was meant for urban cities.
Right.
But as you do when you work on legislation, other things get put in there, and our rural communities have been under the Growth Management Act for a long time, and it's really hampered our ability to have common sense ways of growing our communities, protecting our open spaces, critical areas. But my bill would simply say, so right now in law, every 10 years, a county has to come up, they have to do an update to their comprehensive plan. A lot of times counties end up, getting appealed, litigated, whatever the thing is, where the amount of time it takes to get through that planning process takes, it could be multiple years. And then the statute says, oh, well, maybe it took you 5 or 6 years, and guess what? 4 years from then, you have to come up with another plan. My bill would simply give flexibility to say it would be 10 years from the essentially when you completed, when that process was finalized. It just gives an option. Of course, the other side doesn't like it, and I'm just trying to give local government space and city space through this planning morass. It doesn't undo anything. It just gives them time.
Do you have a bill, a representative bill that you wanted to highlight?
Yeah, I've got a couple of bills that I'm working on that are at varying stages in the process. One bill that's been filed is a little bill I'm kind of proud of. It's a bill that would change our Washington State recognition of President's Day to George Washington's birthday observed, which would take us back to the original intent of the holiday. I'm also working on some bills pertaining to our judicial system, including looking at our juror pay. So we pay jurors about $10 a day. It's been static from roughly the 1950s, so we are looking at that. And I'm also working on a bill that would provide for legislative confirmation of certain appointments by the governor to vacant judicial positions. And there's part of that is a constitutional, piece to it for our Superior Court and our Supreme Court. But the Court of Appeals was established by statute, so that might be sort of our canary in the mineshaft there, because that could be done legislatively. Some additional pieces still coming together on that. But my theory with this is that appointments as a judge are different than other appointments made by the governor. It's really vital that there be public trust and confidence that we're not getting, just a politician in robes there in that position. We want somebody who's going to be recognized as fair and impartial. I'm also working on a bill, and I think there's a window of opportunity on this, and I'll be talking about this with Senator Short and Representative Engel as well, on fire prevention. I think there's a window here to do something on this issue. A lot of people have been paying attention to the fires down in Los Angeles, and it seems it's unfortunate. Sometimes it takes a bad news story for this issue to come back into the forefront of people's minds, but I'm working on that as well.
I have just about a minute left. One thing that's interesting to me, Senator Short, you have two new representatives in your district now. How's it going so far working with these gentlemen?
Oh, it's been amazing. I'm so proud of both of them. We try to have weekly, weekly meetings, answer any questions, just kind of coordinate what we're doing and just a variety of things that folks send our way. And I'll tell you what, they're hitting the ground running. They're strategic. They're talking to people, they're listening, getting advice, and just engaging the people they represent. And I'm just so really, really proud of each of them.
How's it going so far for you, Representative Abel? Representative, we should say, Engel had to step out, but it's first time doing this. 30 seconds. How's it going?
It is. I'll just say, first of all, it's a blessing to have Senator Short's leadership and mentorship in the Senate. We're so fortunate to have you, Senator, advocating for us over there. Representative Engel stepped out. He's out doing work for the people of the 7th District, right? So that's what he's doing. It's a great team. It's a lot of fun. I think we're moving the ball forward in the right direction.
And I'm very much enjoying working with you on these Mondays on Live from Olympia with 7th Legislative District State Senator Shelley Short and Representatives Andrew Engel and Hunter A. Bell. You can hear this every Monday at this time on Okanagan Country Radio. I'm Tracy Ellis with the Washington State Senate Republican Caucus. Have a great day. We'll be right back.